Iran fires ballistic missiles and a precision-guided cruise missile during its drills in the Persian Gulf, saying they are a real warning to Israel. An elderly Palestinian woman dies as an Israeli settler runs her over in the northern occupied West Bank. And Russia says Europe is paying record gas prices because of its own missteps. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says its large-scale drills in the Persian Gulf area serve as a real warning to Israel.
These maneuvers, particularly today's exercises, carried a very clear and explicit message, and that's a serious, real, and battlefield warning to the Zionist regime's officials, who have repeatedly issued anti-Iran threats, to beware of their mistakes and errors. In case of a misstep by them, we will cut off their hands.
IRGC's Chief Major General Hossein Salami says all it takes to turn the drills into an actual military campaign is realigning the direction of firing the missiles. Meanwhile, the Iranian foreign minister says the drills relay a crushing response to Iran's enemies, but also carry the message of security and camaraderie to friendly and neighboring countries. Friday marked the fifth and final day of IRGC maneuvers in southern Iran. The last day of the drills saw the forces carrying out a simultaneous attack on a mock target by over a dozen ballistic missiles and drones. The IRGC confirmed that the attack was 100% successful. A day earlier, the IRGC also test-fired a naval cruise missile with pinpoint accuracy. John Bosnich is a journalist and political commentator. He believes Iran has taken a proper position by deciding to respond militarily to any enemy threats against the country.
When you've got a country like Israel threatening military action against you regularly, the only possible response is to prepare one's own defenses. And Iran has made it clear that Iran is prepared to defend itself and also make counterstrikes against any aggressor. This is the proper position for any country. And in fact, the United Nations should have already intervened to warn Israel against its threats of aggressive warfare. The United States is also exercising influence on its European military colonies, which is what they are, through NATO. So not only is Iran surrounded and outnumbered by these foreign powers, but Iran has the best option of turning to its own supporters in Russia and China, because the world is tired of war after war after war run primarily by the military-industrial complex of the United States, but largely on the orders of Israel. This has got to stop, and Iran has made both the proper domestic defense moves and the international tie-ups with other countries which have faced U.S. and even Israeli aggression.
An Israeli settler runs over and kills a 60-year-old Palestinian woman in the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah. We've discussed the latest killing of Palestinians with our guests in the News Review program.
Welcome to News Review. A Palestinian woman is dead after an Israeli settler runs over her in a northern occupied West Bank. The 60-year-old succumbed to her injuries before medical help arrived. The incident took place in a Palestinian residential area near Ramallah. It came hours after Israeli settlers, backed by regime forces, attacked a Palestinian village in a nearby area. The troops fired rubber bullets and tear gas, injuring at least 125 Palestinians. Israeli rights group Beit Salem says it has documented over 450 settler attacks on Palestinian villagers, or villages, that is, since early 2020. The group says Israeli forces did not intervene to stop the attacks in the majority of cases and often actively joined in. To discuss this a little bit further, I'm going to bring in Mr. Barry Grossman. He's an international lawyer and political analyst joining us out of Bali, as well as our own correspondent, Mona Kandil, who also comes to you via Skype out of Ramallah. It's good to have you both with me. I guess I'm going to begin with an update from Ramallah and ask Mona to fill us in regarding the latest information. Mona?
Well, yes, as you have said, 60-year-old Palestinian woman, Ghadir Masalmi Fuqaha, from the Palestinian town of Sinjar, northeast Ramallah, she was standing with her husband near the road in order, waiting for a taxi to pick them up. However, that road is also used by Israeli settlers. One of the Israeli settlers was driving his vehicle. He ran over the Palestinian woman and fled the scene. Immediately, the Palestinians gathered around the old woman. Then she was transferred to hospital and she succumbed to her injuries. The Israeli military issued a statement saying that they are investigating the incident and that they don't think the settler ran over his vehicle on purpose, killing the woman. But all the eyewitnesses there can say that she was not standing in the middle of the street or even crossing the street. So it's hitting her on purpose. In the same place in 2014, a similar incident had taken place when an Israeli settler ran his vehicle over two Palestinian school children. They were returning back from school to their village, Sinjar. One of those children, female children, was killed and the other was seriously wounded, and this has caused her disability. Following the recent incidents that what happened yesterday in the village of Burqa, when thousands of Israeli settlers went to the evacuated settlement of Homish in order to prevent the Israeli military to destroy some buildings there. There were clashes between the Palestinian residents of Burqa and the settlers. We are speaking about some 125 Palestinians were wounded. And not only from attacks by the settlers, but also from a fire by the Israeli soldiers there.
Okay, let's turn to our esteemed guests from Bali, Barry Grossman, now to come in. And please share with us, sir, your idea. How do you react to actually to this latest spate of violence that has led to the death of this Palestinian woman, unfortunately?
I find it very difficult not to get angry on a daily basis. This tsunami of war crimes, insofar as the so-called state of Israel is concerned, and murders as, insofar as the actions of individual settlers, is unnerving and beyond outrageous. It's always important to remember that this is the West Bank we're talking about. This is not that part of occupied Palestine where if only following the aborted partition in 1948, one could argue unsuccessfully, I might add, that the Israelis have some claim to a modicum of legitimacy. This is the West Bank, and but for the Oslo Accords, the occupying forces would have no business there. And I guess what troubles me about this is we're seeing this happen over and over and over again without any concern whatsoever being shown by those involved that they might be subjected to a proper criminal investigation. Insofar as there are investigations, they're quite clearly done to create the appearance that the occupation is policing itself in order to avoid any kind of international action in the appropriate international court for criminal actions and war crimes. But make no mistake about it, this incident, as I understand it, involves settlers from a settlement that the Israelis themselves had destroyed. As your introduction to the story stated, there have been over 400 such incidents counted in recent times, and rarely have the occupation forces intervened to render assistance to Palestinians being targeted. It's beyond outrageous. It's a crime beyond words. They will target anybody. They seem to take a special pride in targeting, maiming, and killing women and children, imprisoning their men and their children. It's unacceptable. And I think personally, it's high time that, if nothing else, Mr. Abbas declared the Oslo Accords dead and made such moves as he can make to send the occupation forces on their way out of the West Bank. They have no business being there. They've taken over the West Bank and cut it up like a piece of unrecognizable Swiss cheese. And they really have no claim whatsoever to legitimacy, no matter how biased in their favor one might be.
I really appreciate your participation, Barry Grossman, as well as a good correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, in this edition of News Review.
That's where Moscow says Europe is missing out on Russian gas supplies because of a delay in approving the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. Russia's Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak says Europe is paying record gas prices because of its failure to sign long-term supply contracts. Novak says the pressure could be eased by ending delays to the newly built pipeline running from Russia's Arctic gas fields under the Baltic Sea to Europe via Germany. Some Western officials have accused Moscow of using gas as a tool to pressure the EU to approve Nord Stream 2. The pipeline is being opposed by several European countries, as well as the United States, but Moscow says the increased gas prices are due to inability by European energy firms to book gas orders ahead of the winter. And Russian President Vladimir Putin has elaborated on the country's security proposals to the NATO alliance and the United States, which were presented last week. During an annual speech, he said the NATO's efforts aimed at eastward expansion are unacceptable. He accused the West of reneging on its promises and being dishonest. Our correspondent in Moscow has more in this report.
President Vladimir Putin has talked about Moscow's security proposals presented to the NATO alliance last week. Speaking during his annual press conference, he said it is the Western countries that must immediately give Russia security guarantees, not the other way around.
They told us in the 1990s, not an inch to the east. What is the result? They cheated us. They simply impudently cheated us with NATO's five waves of expansion. Now the corresponding systems are already appearing in Romania and Poland. Have we approached the borders of the US or Britain? They have approached ours, and now they say Ukraine will also be a NATO member.
Prominent Russian journalists who have worked in the presidential pool for 20 years believe that Putin's statements serve as a deterrent against the West.
It seems to me that he should not be fascinated by anything for a long time, but he himself sets the vector of many agreements, follows a path that is sometimes completely unexpected for many, hinting that if it is ignored, then retaliatory actions will follow. And since no one knows what they can be, they start to get scared. This is a deterrent.
Speaking about Ukraine, Putin said that Russia was responding to threats from Kyiv. He said Kyiv does not want to honor the Minsk agreements and adopts laws that run counter to these accords. Putin said Ukraine and the West want to portray Russia as a party of a conflict in that country. He said incumbent Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has been under the influence of radical elements after coming to power, like the country's previous leaders.
There must be tension for the hegemon to change. The hegemon, which is America and the English-speaking world, will not just give itself up. But this hegemon does not have enough strength, and we are watching it trying to enter into negotiations.
On Afghanistan, Putin stated that Afghanistan needs a government that represents its entire people so it can be recognized by the international community. He asserted that the countries that occupied Afghanistan for two decades should be the first to offer aid. He called on the West to unfreeze Afghanistan's financial assets, warning that the country is on the brink of famine.
Putin holds a big press conference every year in December, during which the president often touches on acute international problems and suggests ways to solve them. The statements made by the Russian president during this event are prompted by politicians from different countries, in particular by the opponents of Russia. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Police in the northern Indian state of Uttarakhand say they are investigating an event in which Hindu hardliners called for mass killings of Muslims. The police say they will take strict action against those who fanned the flames of hatred in the city of Haridwar earlier this month. One of the speakers called for the killing of 2 million Muslims to protect Hinduism. Another called for the ethnic cleansing of Muslims, asking Hindus to be ready to do or die. The footage has sparked outrage, with a prominent Muslim figure calling it a case of incitement to genocide. One member of Prime Minister Modi's ruling party was also in attendance, Modi's right-wing Bharatiya Janata Party, and its associated groups are accused of trying to turn India into a Hindu state. Indian Muslims have been increasingly subject to deadly violence since Modi came to power. Our correspondent in New Delhi, Munawar Zaman, says Indian Muslims are subject to various forms of violence, but many anti-Muslim incidents are neither highlighted nor investigated.
Everybody's aware of the fact that it all started since 2014. I mean, the anti-Muslim sentiments and anti-Muslim rhetoric all started building up from the 2014 when the ruling BJP came into power in the country. So this is not the first incident. We have seen many incidents that have never come to the limelight and they were never investigated. It's just the one incident that has gained a spotlight or that has gained an attention is because of the fact there are many reasons behind that probably, but most of the times when there are election campaigns or election fever that is gripping the country, and these things are common. Whenever there are elections in India, there is certain element or certain thing that they pick up and start debating or I'm talking about the elements like these far-right groups, Hindutva elements. They start picking up certain subjects and they somehow want to grab attention. They want to grab the public imagination. And it's been happening since quite a while. Muslims have been facing tremendous amount of discrimination, repression in many forms. There's not just one sort of repression. There are so many things that campaigns that they started.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Now, the U.S. was already in crisis in the education sector long before the pandemic even hit. On top of its traditional issues, such as high college debt, it's also facing new ones like pandemic shutdowns and growing controversies over curriculum, masks, and vaccines. Therefore, it should come as no surprise that in the 2020-21 school year, international student enrollment at U.S. universities fell a whopping 15%. Now, the status of education in general is reportedly deteriorating, making certain activists and politicians wonder what needs to be done. And despite efforts by certain progressive lawmakers, high student loans just keep adding to the burden of those seeking knowledge in American universities.
U.S. education hardships.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in this episode, we'll try to get to the bottom of education in the United States, the hardships that students are facing, and what could be done about it. My first guest in this episode will be Dr. Jameson Brewer, an assistant professor of social foundations of education at the University of North Georgia with expertise in education policy, surrounding issues of public schools, the privatization of schools, and issues of equity and justice. And later in the show, I'll be joined by Garland Nixon, a radio talk show host and political analyst. Now, Mr. Nixon is also an outspoken civil libertarian and First Amendment advocate, currently serving on the National Board of Directors for the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU. Now, my first question for Mr. Brewer, we asked his take on the expenses of education in a so-called developed country such as America.
In thinking about what it takes in terms of a financial cost to educate, this is something that I think every country should consider and, in fact, consider the ability to increase, because whatever it is that we spend in education is a direct investment, not just into our current children and our societies and countries, but it's a direct investment in the future. I do think that there are some ways that the United States can think through how to more adequately and equitably fund education across different districts that tend to still remain segregated based on race and class lines.
The U.S. education system was used to be held in high esteem. But today, there is ample evidence to suggest that American schools perform worse than schools in many other countries. The U.S. ranks towards the bottom of the industrialized nations on international tests of academic achievement in science and mathematics.
Personally, I think that there could be conversations about reducing some of the administrative bloat that has grown over the past couple of decades. But again, you know, the money that we spend here in the United States on education should be understood as a direct investment, not just in our current children, but who those children will become in future society as adults.
Meanwhile, the country consumes more resources than any other school systems in the developed world. An increasing number of American schools have declined in quality or have been bested by school systems in other countries. Now, with politicians mostly remaining ignorant of the issue, American schools are less efficient than those of many other countries. Now, thank you for joining us, Mr. Nixon. As you know, education in the U.S. remains quite expensive, unlike many other countries on par with it. Why do you think that is?
I think the principal reason is because the federal government does not prioritize education. If you look at our budget, as an example, the year 2020. In 2020, the military budget was about $730 billion. The education budget was about 11% of that at $74 billion. So the big problem, I think, is that the United States doesn't spend the money necessary to upgrade our educational facilities, to provide, I mean, the simple the simple day-to-day needs in the classroom oftentimes aren't met for the students and teachers. So the number one problem with our educational system is that it's such a low priority. The United States doesn't look at the long term, and it seems to be almost problematic to ask the United States to add money to the educational system. In fact, when you talk about it in the mainstream media, what we often hear is, well, you can't just throw money at them.
The U.S. education system is marked with a series of serious issues, some of which surface in daily news every now and then. The United States is a country that is leading the world in various sectors, such as the military and economic development. But when it comes to education, Washington lags behind its peers, both in policy making and the premises of free education.
Most of the money that comes in the system or into the school system, rather than coming from the federal government, it comes from the locality, from the city or town or county that the schools are placed in. And so if you live in a county that's very wealthy, there's a lot of tax money, those schools are very well subsidized. But if you live in an area that's poor, there's not as much money, and those schools don't have as much, don't have the resources. So we end up with a natural equality from the system, a natural economic equality. Now, from the issue of a racial equality that exists because, and again, people who don't understand the history of America don't know that when America very recently, up until recently, was an apartheid system, the way the schools worked were the white schools got the new books, the new chairs, everything new. Once they had worn them out and they were, the pages were torn out of the books and the desks were broken up, they then sent them to the black schools, and the black schools got everything second-handed.
A large number of students in the country face daily struggles, many of which emanate from simply bad policies and, of course, corruption by power-hungry politicians. As a result, the quality of education is decreasing in the U.S., while an increasing number of students fancy studying in other developed countries, namely in Europe. What is the situation of the U.S. student loan system? How does it make the students indebted for years after their graduation?
Really, up until the mid-1980s, both the federal but mostly the state governments heavily subsidized the cost of attending college. And so while the students prior to the 1980s who attended university did have to pay portions of tuition and housing and food, those costs were very significantly lower than what they are today. With the 1980s and the rise of neoliberalism, and the reimagining of higher education as an individualistic commodity, as opposed to seeing it as an investment for the public or the common good, the cost of higher education has almost fully been shifted to the individual student.
Now, more than 60 years after Brown versus Board of Education, which supposedly made establishing racial segregation in public schools unconstitutional, U.S. education is still marked by racism and remains unequal. As a percentage of students of color grows, inequality in the education sector could shift further in favor of the white minority.
Yeah, bullying in schools has always existed. Certainly with the rise of social media and the internet, it feels magnified in a lot of ways it is. Right? We get the sort of creation of cyberbullying. And it makes it very difficult for a student who is experiencing bullying at school for them to be connected to their peers through social media 24/7. It extends that experience back to the home or for the student outside of school. The only way to address bullying and the only way to address racial slurs or race-based bullying is to have conversations with students, with parents, with communities, and engage in diversity learning for all of our members of society.
Education in the U.S. is tough due to all these problems, but it is indeed tougher for African Americans, Hispanics, Muslims, etc. So what do you think could be done about bullying and racial slurs in the U.S. education system?
Well, the United States is, again, a lot of that started with the integration of schools. You had, of course, you know, black students in one in an entirely separate school system from the white students. When those two were brought together, there was certainly no there was no shortage of problems as a result of that. Now, I think what we're looking at is a reflection of the problems in our society. So what we see in school with the issues of bullying, what we see in schools with the issue of racism and discrimination and things of that nature are a reflection of what's going on in the cultural disintegration of American society. And I think the cultural disintegration is brought about by the economic inequality, by the unfortunate use of race and sex and gender and things of those nature.
Not much has been done to tackle issues related to education within the past decade. Sometimes politicians in power themselves complain about it, but to no avail. Take former President Barack Obama and his wife, or current Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, enumerating hurdles they faced to pay off student debts.
Representative Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez.
Thank you so much, Representative Bowman. And we're here, Bronx, Boogie Down Caucus checking in, Yurt Caucus checking in, Student Loan Cancellation Caucus checking in, because this is getting ridiculous. This is ridiculous.
Today, some 10% of Congress hold student debts, either personally or for a family member. It is important to note that these are some of the most successful men and women in America, which puts the situation for the common people in perspective. What does the decline in the number of international students at U.S. colleges mean for the country's education system?
I think that international students provide a great addition to the diversity that we have on our university campuses. Certainly, with the rise of the COVID pandemic, we have seen a large decrease in the number of international students. And to be perfectly honest, I think that the majority of that is specifically a response to COVID and to travel restrictions. I fully anticipate that once we begin to move past COVID, that we will see international student populations begin to move back towards what they were prior to the pandemic.
Now, the plight of Muslim students in the U.S. is even harsher, particularly for women with the hijab. They're often subject to various forms of harassment in public, involving cases in which the assaulter tries to remove their hijab. That makes observing the religious dress code a daily challenge for female Muslims in American schools.
The last day of my eighth grade year, I was just going home, and then this boy, I think he was a year younger than me, he pulled off my hijab. And at the time, I was wearing a longer one, so it was more easy to kind of like pull off from the back. And then I also had like a pin underneath to hold it in place, and then that kind of came loose. So like at the time, I was just trying to think of like five different things at one time, like trying to get the pin to not like stab me in the neck and then turn around to see who this kid is.
Muslim students frequently get slurs from racists calling them terrorists. Racial profiling and harassment of Muslim students is part of the broader issue of Islamophobia in America, a phenomenon that has been on the rise recently, with white nationalists and other anti-Muslim groups unashamedly speaking out about their sentiments.
You know, what we're looking at is something that is reflecting the United States culture, and that is that our students, they turn on the television and they see the U.S.'s aggressive policies towards the Muslim countries. They see what the U.S. is doing in the Middle East, a total disregard for human life, a total disregard for human culture, an attempt to portray a Muslim the Muslim society as vicious and violent and, you know, as just madmen, as the United States, you know, takes the lives of hundreds of thousands of innocent men, women and children in the Muslim community, in the Muslim world. So I think that the the children of our society are seeing what their government's doing, and, you know, regardless of what they're told.
Inequities in the U.S. education system do not only harm children, but cast their shadows on the lives of people until they are 40 or 50. Studying in the U.S. basically means being indebted to the government forever. Unfair student loans make their payoff a challenge for years to come after graduation.
Now currently, some 45 million borrowers owe more than $1.5 trillion in student loans in America. Exorbitant amounts of borrowed money and interest students have to pay back makes education a financial burden for many, which continues into their middle ages, which equates to people stuck in debt for years after graduation. And inequality only compounds this pressing issue in the U.S. system of higher learning. So how do you think that has affected education?
If we are to imagine schooling as providing an equal opportunity or level playing field for students to actualize their potential and move into adulthood and having equal opportunities, we have to be very honest about the reality that we are not providing an equal opportunity for all students to have that education in the United States. It does fall along class and racial lines here in the U.S., as I mentioned earlier. Students, schools that serve dominantly white students receive an excessive amount of additional money each year than schools that serve non-white students. And again, this is almost entirely because of the variation in property taxes.
There seems to be no end in sight for bad news about the U.S. education, although there are efforts underway to change that. From inequality to student loans to racism or bullying, the U.S. faces a long list of issues impacting its education sector.
And even in thinking about what we spend on kindergarten through the 12th grade, we do spend quite a bit. But again, we should understand that as an investment. And here in the United States, all students, regardless of where they come from, regardless of their own developmental position where they are relative to their current grade, we've made a commitment to educate every single child.
Sponsored by Muslim Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, and Senator Bernie Sanders, the College for All Act is aiming to eliminate tuition and fees at all public four-year colleges and universities, community colleges, and trade schools. That could ameliorate the situation for a lot of students. But can it go through the ranks of power and actually materialize?
Black students' contribution to revolutionary movements is a topic which Abbas Muntahim shares with us today. Let's have a look.
What's going on, my people, and welcome back to Power to the People. Today on the show, we're going to discuss some of the revolutionary history of black students and how black students have been essential in the black radical tradition. So let's get into it, you feel me? Thank y'all for rocking with me. So we must understand that black students have been an integral part of movements seeking to end Euro-American colonial domination. In the Civil Rights Movement, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, often referred to as SNCC, was formed to organize the black community in the racist Jim Crow South. SNCC organized student-led sit-ins at segregated lunch counters, as well as boycotts, protests, and voter registration to combat Jim Crow-era voter disenfranchisement. They also organized what they called Freedom Summers, in which hundreds of students, volunteers, went into Mississippi for mass voter drives, as well as establishing freedom schools for black youth. This organizing led to racist violence from the state and vigilantes. SNCC members were regularly harassed, beaten, murdered, and brutalized by law enforcement and the Ku Klux Klan. And we know that members of the KKK were also cops. The violence of white supremacy, as well as the lack of change through the so-called bourgeoisie democratic electoral process, it led to some of SNCC's members radicalizing and beginning to reject the nonviolent stance of the Civil Rights Movement. One of these members was none other than Stokely Carmichael, who was later known as Kwame Ture. Kwame Ture, he popularized the phrase black power and advocated for the complete independence of our people, as well as picking up arms to defend ourselves from colonial violence, as we know it is our human right to do so. A$AP Brown, who later changed his name to Jamil Al-Amin, he then became the leader of SNCC. He took the N for nonviolence out of SNCC and replaced it with the N for national. He also made a public alliance with the Black Panther Party in Oakland, California, and ended up joining the Black Panther Party as well. We must understand that this was a natural evolution for Black student organizing, and it became more militant due to the conditions of this racist, white supremacist violence that Black students was facing. Black students began arming themselves to defend themselves from white terrorism. One example of this was the Black Panther Party, as the party evolved out of the Black student movement as well. Both Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, who co-founded the Black Panther Party, they were both students when they met at Merritt Junior College in North Oakland, California. While they were students, they co-founded the Seoul Students Advisory Committee, which is the predecessor of the Black Student Union. And today, there's BSUs at colleges and high schools throughout the whole country. The Oakland Police Department, they was regularly harassing, brutalizing, and murdering Black people. And Huey and Bobby, they founded the Black Panther Party to combat this violence from the police. The first recruit to the Black Panther Party was 16-year-old little Bobby Hutton. And their junior college, Merritt College, has served as a recruiting ground. And one of their first actions was to legally start patrolling the pigs while carrying shotguns. And they were some real boys. The Black Panther Party is also responsible for helping create Black Studies. As point 5 of the 10-point program said, they wanted a true education for their people. And at Merritt College, Black Studies was created due to Black student organizing. And the first chair of the department was Melvin Newton, who was a member of the Black Panther Party and Huey Newton's brother. And now if we look at Black Studies today, there's Black Studies departments and African American Studies departments all throughout the country. And this is because of the Black militant students who paved the way for a whole new department to exist. We must pay a homage to this militant history. And today, Black student movements, they have been fighting to end colonial violence. When I was a student at UC Berkeley, we was organizing and we fought for 10 demands for institutional change. We shut down the campus' biggest restaurant and blocked off the entrance to the school on its biggest recruitment day. All this organizing led to the creation of the Fannie Willhammer Black Resource Center, which is a vital hub for Black students to not only study out of, but to begin to organize. We also forced the University of California school system to divest $30 million from these private prisons. And it isn't just Black students in America who've been fighting back against racism. Black students across the world have been fighting back. In South Africa, students organized the Roads Must Fall campaign, which called for the removal of the statue of the genocidal terrorist named Cecil Rhodes, who was a British colonialist and a so-called prime minister in Cape Colony. South African students also organized a campaign called Fees Must Fall in response to a 10.5% tuition increase. And they were successful as African students organized en masse to stop institutions from increasing tuition. Black students are fundamental for the revolution. As Huey Newton said, the youth inherit the revolution, and Black students must realize and actualize their role in revolution. As Julia Luther King said, students must recognize that their education is not solely for individual gain and pleasure, but rather for the building of minds to serve the movement and the nation, and that nation being the new African nation. This is Power to the People.
Well, everyone, thank you for watching our program. At the end of this episode, I'd like to wish all the students a peaceful journey in their quest for knowledge, both in the U.S. and elsewhere throughout the world. Thank you for staying with us. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Make sure to tune in again next week when we come back with another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned. Home is the best place for asceticism. If you want to live like a spiritual wayfarer, the best place is home. Of course, there are certain types of ascetic deeds which need spiritual trainer. However, I believe that the best place to grow spiritually is inside the house and with the family. Once, a person went to Allama Tabatabai and asked him for spiritual guidelines on spiritual development. Upon hearing this request, Allama Tabatabai asked him, "Are you married or single? What has it to do with spiritual growth?" The man asked.
یه چیزایی برای شخصی که مجرد هست عبادت و او رو به خدا نزدیک میکنه که اگه همون
علامه answered, some deeds which are considered spiritual for a single person will be harmful for a married one. This means that married people and single ones might have different spiritual experiences which are not necessarily the same. For instance, going to the mosque up until midnight and help to take care of the affairs of the mosque will be great for a single person, but might be harmful for a married person who must be inside the house and take care of the affairs of the family. Worshipping Allah is not always being inside a mosque or religious gatherings. It can be manifested in doing the house chores and helping the family too. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.